Hey, this is Rob Harder with Making Your World Better, a nonprofit leadership show where real stories from real people who are coming up with real solutions to solve society's biggest challenges. What does it take to be an effective nonprofit leader today? How do people fundraise in an economy that is constantly in flux? How do you relate to board members in a way that inspires them to make a difference? What are the best practices that separate effective nonprofits from others? It is my hope that through these episodes, people can learn not only what it takes to be an effective nonprofit organization, but to hear real stories from real leaders who are successfully making a positive impact in their communities. We hope you enjoy this series as together we hear how they're making their world better. Today we have in the studio Greg Spencer. He is the co-founder and chairman of the board for The Paradigm Project. It is a fantastic business. I know you're like, wait a second, this is a nonprofit leadership podcast, but here's the thing. He talks about the binary approach that many people have when it comes to for-profit versus nonprofit. And what he's doing with his for-profit business called The Paradigm Project is that he's basically creating all of his earnings and applying those to a nonprofit purpose. In fact, he talks about how there's often this separation between the two types of businesses, if you want to call it that, or two types of organizations. And really, the wave of the future is that nonprofits are leaning towards and learning from for-profits in terms of efficiency and mission focus and effectiveness and having accountability with their staff and their ED. On the flip side, for-profits are becoming a little bit more socially minded, that it's not just enough to make the bottom line and make a lot of money, but it needs to make good in the community that it serves, and it needs to make a difference in the world that we live. So here's a real model. Greg is actually, through the Paradigm Project, providing a real model for both businesses and nonprofits to learn from. In fact, his perspective may change your paradigm. You're going to really enjoy today's show. I'm confident of that. Thanks for listening to the Nonprofit Leadership Podcast. Greg, it's great to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be here with you, buddy.
He's a good friend, and he's on the board here at the Christian Center of Park City, so it's so fun to have both a friend, but someone who really has a lot of experience and a lot of insight into this whole nonprofit world and how it blends with the for-profit world. So with that, Greg, talk a little bit about yourself, number one, how you've gotten involved with various nonprofits, and specifically about the Paradigm Project.
Wow, Rob, I don't even know where to begin with that question. I had my father was a guy who was raised on a poor farm in Louisiana and became a Fortune 500 CEO. He was a professional singer. He was an amazing golfer. He put himself through college playing both baseball and football. He was truly a remarkable guy. And he taught me that everything he had, contrary to sort of the legend, the myth of being the ultimate self-made man, he taught me that everything he had was a gift. And so at a very young age, I realized that I was a rich Christian in a hungry world, and that imposed a stewardship responsibility on my life and the opportunities I have. And so I've had this amazing opportunity to travel to lots of places in Africa and Central America and Asia. And everywhere I go, I see people who will, in all likelihood, generation after generation after generation, grow up, grow old, and die in the same community as, you know, generations before them, with very little opportunity. And so I just feel overwhelmed at the privilege and the opportunity that I've had to experience and do and try and fail at all the things that I've been involved with. And so history, I went to law school by default because one of my college roommates was, planning to take the LSAT test the next day, and I didn't even know what it was. And so I followed him. I did it. I went to law school as a different avenue into business. I applied for a job that I was grossly unqualified for and still happened to, for some reason, you know, God's grace, I ended up with the job. Opportunities within that job changed regularly, and I kept finding myself doing things that I was, there's Rob, trust me, there's no false humility in this. I'm serious. I got to do things over and over again that I just was unqualified for, and yet somehow the opportunities continued to arise. And looking back from that realization when I was a teenager that I was a rich Christian in a hungry world, I really believe God directed my steps through all of those things to enable me to be in a position where this prayer that I'd had for 25 years, which was to do something that would really directly impact people's lives, could come to realization. And so that's who I am. I'm a business guy who's had a grossly disproportionate, unfair allocation of opportunity and favor, who's had the chance to start businesses, some of which have succeeded, some of which have failed. And, you know, I'm a little overwhelmed at the whole thing, honestly.
What I love, you know, if you get to know Greg Spencer, which I hope you do, listening audience, one of these days, we'll give you his contact information soon. But your humility really comes across as very genuine, and it actually belies the fact that this gentleman has done so much for so many people. So speaking of all your opportunities, one of the things you started recently was called the Paradigm Project. And I really think it's interesting for the listening audience. What I think it does is that it brings the intersection between the for-profit world and the nonprofit world. So talk a little bit about the Paradigm Project specifically, and how you have sought to kind of maybe turn upside down on its head the role of a for-profit, how it impacts positively a non-for-profit.
It's crazy. I at the time we started Paradigm, I'd never heard of the term social venture or impact investment or any of that. I just had never been part of a non-profit. I'd always been in business, and I'd always had this desire to impact people's lives. And so for me, it just made natural sense when I began, having started a climate change company back in 2000 called Blue Source. And Blue Source works with Fortune 500 companies primarily, is the leader in the forestry space, but it's I think the leading developer of carbon offset projects in North America today. We have offices in Canada and a couple in the US. And the idea of using carbon finance to do development work was, you know, literally something that I don't know, just it felt like an epiphany, okay? But what I learned after starting Paradigm with my good friend and business partner, Neil Belfay, is that the idea of eliminating this binary nature of a for-profit and a nonprofit had been out there for a long time, and that the momentum that has been visible over the last decade actually started, I think, long before that. I was just completely unaware of it. And the beauty of it is that in the past, people would make money in business and then set aside some of that money for a foundation that would do good work. And so they had these mutually exclusive parts of their vocation or their lives or their investment portfolio where one side was all about making money, period. The other side was all about trying to do good. And, you know, that the problem is that neither of those are really effective independently. And what you end up with then is this culture where you have this extremely efficient for-profit culture with that's demanding and accountability and all of that. And then you have this nonprofit culture where people were expected to earn less because they were paid less, because they were required to do less. And it was terribly destructive to this, you know, just frankly contributing at a level that of excellence that should be demanded of everyone, regardless of where they work or what they do. So, again, I was ignorant of so many things, but including this, the blending, the graying of the boundaries between for-profit and non-profit. And it's fantastic because each has elements that they need of the other. And I think that's what finally broke down the binary nature of it, that allowed organizations to sit in the middle of this spectrum, like Paradigm, which has the heart and the mission of a nonprofit, but is structured as a for-profit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So talk about it a little bit more, because I think the listening audience would really like to know, give me some brass tacks here. So how's it structured? What's your board like? And then, yeah, how do you then fund this nonprofit side, if you will, to the for-profit?
We were actually one of the early L3Cs, which you know, some of you that will care about this, most of you won't. So an L3C is a limited profit, low liability, a low profit, limited liability company. It's essentially an L3C that has to have as a primary part of its reason for existence a dominant social mission. So we decided to become an L3C. We were one of the early adopters. We were one of the few that survived, frankly. And the purpose of the company is really to, it's a different way of addressing poverty. So we wanted to impact people at the bottom of the economic pyramid in a way that was sustainable and scalable, because the problem we're trying to address really affects almost half the planet. About 3 billion people still cook over an open fire, and the World Health Organization says that that is the leading cause of death globally for children under five. 4.3 million women and children a year die from lower respiratory disease caused by indoor cooking smoke, which can largely be avoided, not entirely, by using the same fuel, but just combusting it more effectively. And so our primary business is to use business to change people's lives. The primary product we use to achieve that is the sale of these very small, very efficient, low-cost household cook stoves.
So I just said something very, very insightful, that you have a business model that is in the business of saving lives or impacting lives. So, and again, you're talking about one of the biggest issues that I think is a surprise. I've heard you share this before, but I think, again, for the listening audience, I think you think of AIDS or malaria or other big epidemics like that. And yet one of the biggest issues is smoke inhalation and all the things that go with that. So yeah, so talk a little bit more about how you have structured your for-profit and how it works on the ground.
Well, I have to admit that our original business model didn't work out. So coming from Blue Source and the carbon development, carbon finance model, we were selling the stoves at a loss and making up the loss and generating a return for our three dozen investors by using the carbon offset. Then about 2 years into the business, the carbon markets imploded. And what was a slam dunk 30% IRR for our investors became an entirely different challenge, because now we had to develop a profit on this multi-stage distribution model that at the end of the day still had to get the stoves into the customer's hands at an affordable price. And affordability is a bigger challenge than price in the majority world. And so the model now is that we have gone through pretty extraordinary efforts and been ridiculously fortunate at the same time to completely change our revenue model so that we can generate a margin and still sell stoves to the end customer at about $15.80, which, you know, is hard for people outside the industry to appreciate, but it is really, really difficult.
And not only have you done a really good job with your business model, but you also you've done multiple things. Like, number one, you're saving greenhouse gases, right? You're improving these lives where women often that would be their job was to go get the wood. Now they have more time on their hands, and you've actually invested in women who now have their own stove business that now they're entrepreneurs, if you will, in their home countries. Talk a little bit about that, maybe the people impact and the environmental impact. I think people would love to hear how a good business is doing good in the world.
You know, it's funny because it just doesn't translate in our culture. That when you can walk over and push the button on the microwave or turn the knob on your stovetop to cook, that the fact that other people use wood just doesn't mean a lot until you've experienced it. But to give you an example, Rob, a single stove on average will save anywhere between 8 and 12 tons of greenhouse gases. It will save a woman about $280 in income. But now think about that on a $15 purchase price. I mean, there are places where independent firms have measured a 5,000% return on investment for the consumer, which has a dramatic financial impact when you're in the survival trap of just trying to figure out how you're going to eat tomorrow. In addition to that, it can save as much as 300 hours of time, 33 trees. And so you know, we are so fortunate, Rob. I can't even tell you. It is the hardest industry I've ever worked in, but over the last 7 years, Paradigm collectively has been able to save close to 1 million tons of greenhouse gas, $65 million of income for our customers, 75 million hours of time saved in not gathering wood, which is a more brutal, difficult process in the increasingly deforested areas of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay, you got to time out a little bit. Right. Repeat those one more time, because that is astounding. I mean, that's why I love Paradigm Project. What you're doing is incredible. So talk one more time about those stats, because I just want to make sure that the audience hears what impact you're making, because it's incredible.
So collectively, in the sale of roughly 140,000 stoves, excluding those that have been sold by partners for which we help them with the carbon, like in Guatemala and other places in Africa, about 1 million tons of greenhouse gas, 4.5 million trees have been saved, 65 million dollars, 75 million hours of time. And you just, you know, people in this culture don't appreciate how male dominant many developing countries are. And so when you can go to a woman and give her the opportunity not only to change the economics and the health of her own household and just the ability of her ability to invest time in other productive uses other than gathering, you know, 50 pounds of wood and walking 5 or 6 miles each way and then going to fetch the water, to actually enable them to do farming or childcare or whatever, you know, that by itself is truly dramatic. But
I'm glad you said that. I want to interrupt you real quick, just because you had mentioned this before. Mention to the listening audience again, they've done studies on this where they've invested, say, in a woman in a village that often you're serving, and they've actually studied this, that if they invest in a woman who has their own business, for example, versus a man for whatever reason, the impact to the entire community and the family is greater. Talk about that. Is that accurate? Did I hear that correctly?
Listen, everything I've seen suggests that is accurate. And you know, for all the men who happen to be listening to this, I want to apologize in advance, but the truth is, guys, that we're the weaker gender. Grossly true. When you get into the developing world and you see, now this is, you know, stereotypes are never fair. They're never accurate. They're never fair. But you see an awful lot of men who are, quote, shepherds, which means they're standing out in the fields, leaning on their staff, and women carrying water, I mean, heavy, heavy loads, even women in their 60s. I've seen women in their mid-60s who will spend 12 or 14 hours hiking up a mountain in order to get the remaining wood that's available to be harvested, and then carrying 50 pounds of wood back to their home just to be able to cook. That without refrigeration, we just don't appreciate that if you don't have fuel, you don't cook. If you don't cook, you don't eat. And I mean, so this is a matter of survival, and yet the stories I've seen and I've participated in wood walks with women, Rob, you can't believe that in so many places the guys, I'll give you an example. I hate to pick on somebody, but there was a Christian guy working for a Christian aid organization who bragged to me one day that on the birth of their fifth child, the day that his wife gave birth, he carried the wood for the first time. And he was so proud of the fact that the day she gave birth, he went out to get the wood for her. Now, I mean, think about that. In this country, if that was the only day in which I went out to gather the wood, my wife would just slap me silly.
Well said. That guy was not up for husband of the year. We'll just say it that way.
No, but the point is just that the disparity in the allocation of physical labor is just, in again, from my cultural perspective, which has all kinds of limitations, it's just wrong, and it's painful to watch. And then you extrapolate that to what it means for women in terms of opportunity and the ability to generate an income and lead, you know, contribute to the household and be considered a partner in the marriage and all that. And, you know, so much of what we try to do is not just achieve those bottom line, you know, multiple bottom line benefits, but we want to do it in a way that, that conveys, that creates dignity in the lives of the people that we want to serve. And so when you hand someone something, and look, I'm not picking on aid organizations because I don't think you'll ever get to a point where aid isn't necessary along with development. There are just too many crises in the world, natural disasters, civil wars, all that. But when you give one, someone something, particularly in a country, in a continent like Africa, where there's been so much aid, what you're telling someone is, since you can't help yourself, you know, the white guy's here to help you and to solve your problem. And it's obnoxious and it's ineffective. And we have wasted trillions of dollars trying to solve the problems there because we thought we knew the right answer. But when you treat someone with respect and recognize their intelligence and believe that they can make intelligent choices and they pay for something, you know, full value, but fair value, and you treat them like, you know, I want your respect as a consumer. I want your, I want to deal with you honestly and honorably. And if this doesn't work out, I'm not going to be like everybody else you've dealt with. I'm coming back to help you with your problem. We're not perfect as an organization, but we are deeply motivated to bring dignity and respect to the people we deal with. And so when the women who have had no opportunity, it's one thing to buy a stove, but those who have purchased a stove then have this desire to be able to transfer this benefit, to extend this benefit to their neighbors. So some of them we hire and they become sales agents and they wear uniforms and they get paid a college graduate salary and, you know, they have the opportunity to become managers and to hire other people. And I just, you can't imagine how much fun it is to watch the transformation and the empowerment that happens when you give someone opportunity, which is why, you know, back to my opening statement, I get so overwhelmed when I travel through these communities out in the middle of nowhere. And I think about how easily I could have been one of those guys who never had any opportunity other than what the 20 generations of men before me did.
Well, and that's so powerful because normally it's coming from your heart. This is your personal experience. But you said something really, really significant in that when you honor other people's dignity and you believe in them and you believe that they can actually do this and you give them the tools to do it, or you help assist them in giving them options, you know, where they can choose what they want to do with the tools that are given to them. Love that. I think that makes all the difference in the world in terms of development that works, particularly in these other countries. And so, well said. Let me ask you now a question. We're running out of time a little bit, and we could talk forever about this.
I get kind of passionate, so I apologize.
I think a little bit, which is great. I love it. A listener's going to love that. So talk about this model that you have. You talked about a social venture. We've had people talk about social entrepreneurial mindsets now that are happening with both for-profits and nonprofits. Is this a model, that the Paradigm Project model, is this a model you think more for-profits, number one, should go towards, or even non-for-profits, should they start looking at this as a different way to maybe achieve the mission of what they're about, the needs they're trying to meet? Perhaps they need to totally revamp the way they're doing it. Talk about that a bit.
Well, that's a huge question.
I know, sorry. You've got 5 minutes to answer it.
When I talked about how the morphing of the for-profit and the non-profit models and how each are need to adopt certain aspects of the other, I think that's what's happening. I think for-profit companies, 100 years ago, there was no such thing as a company that was just dedicated to making money. If that was your only purpose, the community had no interest in you. And you know, it's really been, and I think, I'm no historian, but I think in the last 50 or 60 years, the pendulum has swung so far from being a community-oriented, community-benefiting organization that was designed to make money to, you know, investors requiring that 100% of your focus be dedicated to providing their return, which is just kind of a sick indictment on our culture, but it's a reality. And at the same time, the nonprofit organizations, you know, had a mission, and as long as they were kind of trying to do their best, and they weren't doing anything illegal or immoral. They, you know, their accountability, frankly, got kind of pathetic. And so you had this widening of the gap between the for and the nonprofit that now is reversing itself, where companies realize it's not just about PR. I really have to be about something more than generating profit if I really want to be sustainable. And the whole concept of sustainability is morphing and developing and growing to something that was originally PR. I mean, just, I want to look good, to, I realize I really have to be about more if this organization is going to continue, and particularly with the growth of millennials moving into management and looking for an opportunity to make a difference in the world, that for-profit only model just doesn't sell very well anymore. And then on the flip side is the nonprofit community, which is realizing that donors are investors. They're not content just to keep writing a check and say, you know, good luck, I hope it works out okay. They want to know, what are you going to do with my money? And when I give you this check, can you tell me what impact it's going to have? I love your mission, but I need to know more than that, because I've got 10,000 opportunities of where I'm going to deploy this capital. And, you know, I've personally, I believe for a long time that whether I give the money away or put it into something that is expected to generate a financial return, my responsibility is the same. My stewardship responsibility is exactly the same. And so nonprofits are having to develop more specific metrics. You know, what am I going to achieve? How am I going to quantify it? How will I know whether I'm successful or not in what I'm pursuing? And you know, are there complaints that you're trying to turn the nonprofit into a business? You're trying to turn our church into a business model? Yeah, you know, sure, there are lots of those complaints out there, and occasionally they're warranted. But the truth is, I think the underlying goal is more just, how do we develop a system of rational, reasonable accountability that determines whether you're succeeding or not? How do I know if you're successful if you're not even measuring what it is you're trying to do? You know, the downside is that a lot of reasons why nonprofits exist don't subject themselves well to metrics. And so that's where the tension arises. And, you know, there's also a huge growth, as you know well, because of the Christian Center. There's a huge growth toward how much of your revenue, your funding requirements, can you generate on your own through your own activities? And again, you know, is that an appropriate place for a church? Well, the immediate reaction is no, but maybe that's not true when you think about a preschool. Churches can run preschools, but they may not know how to. They bring in an advisor who is capable of doing that and generating a profit, and you achieve the social objective and the financial return. And so I think it's just really easy for nonprofits to dismiss that because of the cultural, you know, look, that's not who we are. But the reality is the responsibility, the stewardship responsibility they have to their donors, I think should require them to step back and think, you know, what can I do to replace some of the donor capital that I need every year with revenue that is generated and is perfectly consistent with my mission and doesn't run afoul of the IRS, you know, unearned, whatever it is, the limitation on generating unrelated business income. So,
Greg, thank you so much. Now, I think a lot of the listeners are going to want to find out more about the Paradigm Project. Where can they find out more about the Paradigm Project?
Our website is pretty simple, but it takes a while to write out, theparadigmproject.org.
Great. And I'm assuming for your contact information, it's on that website. Anything else you want to say about the Paradigm Project or how people can find out more information?
No, I just I want to just challenge the norms that are out there in our culture that are, I think, eroding quickly. But regardless of which side of the fence you find yourself on, either the for or the nonprofit, realize that there is so much opportunity in the middle of that spectrum to do good and to generate a return. And is it more difficult to find? Of course it is. But it's also dramatically more rewarding when you can find something that involves principles of business excellence with, you know, improving the quality of culture, mankind, someone's life. So,
well, I love it. And I thank you again for what you're doing, Greg. You do really, really good work. And I knew this was going to be for the listeners a real treat to hear Greg's thoughts and insights. Thank you for all you do to make the world better. You really do a great job. And you're such a humble guy about it, but you really are making a difference. Thanks for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Rob, for your kindness.
I wanted to let you know that we are on iTunes. If you are wondering how to find out where we are, check us out on iTunes by typing Nonprofit Leadership Podcast or Rob Harder, and this podcast should show up. We also encourage you, when you go on iTunes, let us know what you think. Give us a review. Give us a rating. We would love to hear what you think of this podcast, and your feedback will help us expand this podcast to get it out to as many people as we can. You can also go online to listen to this podcast, either nonprofitleadershippodcast.org or my website, robharder.com. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, keep making your world better.